For those of you who have not been here for the past about 7 weeks or so, we have been going through a series called Christianity 101, and we decided to do that because we want to unpack some specific fundamental, essential doctrines of the historic Christian church. So the first week we covered God's existence, and then we covered the transcendence and immanence of God, and we covered Christology. I'm sorry, we covered the Trinity, and then we covered Christology, which is the study of Christ. We covered pneumatology. By the way, pneumatology is spelled with a silent P, like pneumonia, P-N-E-U-M-A-tology, okay? So that is the study of the Holy Spirit. The word pneuma means wind. So that is the word that was chosen in the New Testament in regards to the Holy Spirit. So that's the term. That's the word determined for the study of that person. Then we also, in the midst of that series, covered both community and we covered mission. And the thing we want to bring to your attention today is the doctrine or the biblical understanding of anthropology. And that is the study of humanity. Anthropos is the word for the Greek word for man or humanity. So we want to have a time today where we discuss briefly the doctrine of humanity. Now, some of you say that. You got to realize when you're preaching, it's a dialogue. And even when no one is saying anything, they're making facial expressions. And when I said that, I noticed them taking note of that. So my immediate response to that was, you were deliberately, skillfully, dare I say, fearfully, and wonderfully made. Because no one caught it. And the manner in which you are made gives you irrevocable value. You are image bearers. And none of the people in this room can take that from you. No one can take that from you. You cannot package it up and hand it off. Why? Because the one who gave it to you is incomparable. You bear his image. He didn't just make you and have you come up with something for you to be. No, he intended for you to look like him. He says of you, both male and female, that you are the bearers of his image. You are the ones who display his likeness. Now, when you go to seminary, one of the debates you're going to have is, what do we mean by image bearer? What does that mean? And everyone kind of splits up into these different categories on what this means. So some people believe that you have the ability to reason, just as God has the ability to reason. And that is a display of you being, that's an evidence of you being an image bearer. My pushback on that is, what do you do with a person who may be so mentally disabled that they don't have the capacity to reason? Well, if you have that understanding of image bearing, then you may be undermining the image value of that person. One of the other arguments is that if you restrict it to reasoning, you may make that mistake. One of the other arguments is that we are inherently communal people, and God is a communal being. And I said, I agree with that. But what do you do with the child who is wrestling with the onslaught of autism and does not have the same capacity to recognize social cues and be in community that everyone else has? By emphasizing community as the means, the sole means by which we display his image, you may be undermining the image value of that child. That's my pushback on that. So how do I read this passage? I would contend that to say that you are made in the image of God is a reference to your responsibility to reign. Because notice what he tells Adam and Eve after he makes them in the image of God. He says you are to exercise dominion over all of creation. Now, you know who exercises ultimate dominion? God. And he then makes image bearers, people who look like him, uniquely, by the way. Angelic beings do not have this quality, and no animal in the animal kingdom has this quality. Human beings are uniquely made in the image of God. And he says to them, after making them in his image, now go and exercise dominion over creation. Now, what's the agenda there? You are supposed to be a miniature animated version of him, so that those who do not recognize his reign over creation can get a glimpse of it by looking at you. God made miniature versions of himself so that the world can extrapolate from the miniature version what the grand idea is. When I was in high school, our military was in Iraq, and one of the things that we did while we were there, after first getting there, there was a whole moment where after they had invaded Kuwait, and then there was this whole mass invasion of Iraq. And I remember as a teenager, I was about 17, 18 years old, so military representation was in my high school all the time, recruiting people for the military, and I was like, I'll kind of have some plans. Other than that, but one of the guys was talking to me, and I was talking to him about this invasion that had just occurred a few days earlier. And he says, I don't know what's about to happen because I'm not privy, I don't have insight, but I do know this, that boy's in trouble. And I said, which boy is that? And he said, oh, Saddam. Yeah, this is Texas, where you deliberately mispronounce someone's name to be disrespectful. Yes, Louis Farrakhan. And Saddam, okay? And I said, okay, so he's in trouble. What does that mean? He says, I don't know yet, but when they catch him, he's in trouble. I said, how do you know that? He said, take note of what our boys did when they got to Iraq. The very first thing they did was they found a statue of him and tore it down. Why? Because when Saddam Hussein put the statue up, it was his agenda to have this miniature, statuesque replica of himself so that everyone who entered this territory can know who reigns over this territory. Are you tracking with that? He made a statue, a replica of himself. Not quite as good as the real thing, but looks enough like the real thing for you to know the one to whom the real thing is referring. And when you walk in and you see this statue in the center of the metropolitan city, everyone who is a visitor to that city knows who reigns here. In fact, there was another statue that was two hands holding two swords that were crossed. Those hands were a replica of Saddam Hussein's hands. And when they got to that statue, the first thing they did was tear it down. Why? It's them letting everyone know that the replica of the real thing can go, because in very near future, the real thing will be gone. The statue of the man can be removed, because in the very near future, the man will be removed. The change of order has come. The one who once reigned over this will no longer reign over it. Okay? Now, here's how God did that very same thing that Saddam Hussein did. He made statues that were replicas of him, so that whenever someone enters the territory, they can know who reigns here. But unlike Saddam Hussein, he doesn't have to make his out of stone. Our God makes animated replicas. So you don't just look like him, you can sound like him. You can move like him. You can serve like him. You can love like him. You can commune like him. So when people see you, they say, there's something significant about you. And you have to point past yourself to point out the significance. I don't look like me. I look like someone else. You live to point toward someone else. That's why he made you in his image. You are animated statues of the king. You are sub-regents. You serve as an exercise dominion under his ultimate dominant reign. That's why you exist. And that is why he made you as an image bearer, so that you can put him on display. Now you're thinking, I don't have that grandness. I can't do what everyone else does. Okay, well, a few a few weeks ago, I was in St. Louis. I preached for a crew conference, Campus Crusade crew, in St. Louis. And it actually wasn't in St. Louis. I flew into St. Louis, and then someone picked me up at the airport, and then we drove for about two and a half hours, and they took me out into the woods. And I remember the very moment when my phone stopped working. It just went from full bars to nothing. The phone just said, no service. So there was no Wi-Fi, there was no television, and there was no telephone. And they said, but you can make phone calls, but there's only, if you have AT&T, because there's only one good spot out here, but you have to walk to the top of the hill, which is about a half mile from the room in which I was staying. Parenthetically, I should tell you this. The room was like a jail cell. The concrete floors and unornamented walls. There was no bedding on the bed, and the mattress was made of plastic. Now, they're all college students, so this is no big deal to them. They all came with sleeping bags, and they're sleeping outside. Listen, I'm old. Yes, I need sheets. Okay, I need sheets. That's all I'm saying, okay? And so I had to, someone loaned me a sleeping bag so I could sleep on this plastic mattress, and I didn't get much sleep. I had a great time because there's just something about being around a bunch of 19, 20-year-olds who are lit for Jesus. So every worship gathering we had was on level 10. I had a great time. I got no sleep, though. I got no sleep because I'm elderly, and I can't be sleeping on this plastic mattress. And they all sleeping outside. It's cold and raining, and they're all in tents outside. Y'all crazy. And they gave me, and no, there was no air conditioning, and it was still hot there. It was just a really interesting time. So I got back to the airport to fly back to Denver. I was tired. I realized how much my time there was motivated and driven by the energy of these young people. So that when I got to the airport and they were all gone, I was crashing. Okay, and I was in the airport in the security line, and there was a father behind me with his daughter, and she was about 4, maybe 5 years old, and she had Down syndrome, and she was the most engaging, extrovert, joy-filled person I have ever met. She was talking to everyone. The line that we were in would result in you having to go a certain distance. You would turn around, and because of you, end up walking past the same person several times. We were making our way to the front of the line, and every single time she passed someone, even though she passed the same person 7, 8, 9, 10 times, she spoke to them, engaged them as though she had never met them before. And it was just, she was the joy of that line. But I'm tired. Haven't had any sleep. And for 3 days, I've been out in the woods. I hear animals creaking in out here. And I was concerned that they were going to bury me on the side of this hill somewhere. Okay? I'm ready to get home where I'm safe and I'm loved. And I know the terrain. I can escape. Okay? I get to the front of the line. And I'm getting ready to take my stuff off and put it on the conveyor belt. And this little bitty hand grabbed my hand. And then used her other hand to rub the back of my hand. And I look at her father. He says, she can tell that you're sad. I was done. I was like, I am so bad attitude that a baby can tell. And she felt the need to come and minister to me in the only way she knew how. And I leaned over, I said, listen to me. You are an image bearer. And today, as a display of your image, you show me what deliberate, selfless love looks like. Don't come to me and tell me I can't do it, because a four-year-old with Downs put the image of God on full display. He gave you him so that you could put him on display. Now, the other thing that's going to come up while you're there in seminary is that we're no longer made in this image, because this happened in Genesis chapter 1, and the fall happened in Genesis chapter 3. Now, here's the problem with that. Genesis chapter 9, verses 5 and 6, address the Old Testament imperative, I would contend the ongoing imperative regarding capital punishment. And the Bible says that he who sheds man's blood shall have his blood shed. Why? Because the blood that was shed, the originally murdered person, is made in the image of God. So in Genesis chapter 9, the author of Genesis appeals to the image that a person bears, the image of God that's intrinsic to a human being, as an argument against murder. But that happened after the fall, after Adam's rebellion. Do I believe that the fall had implications? Yes. I believe it placed a mark. It has marred our capacity to display the image well. But it did not destroy the image. It did not destroy the image. The image cannot be destroyed. I just told you that you cannot give it away, and it cannot be taken away. Every human being has intrinsic value because they bear this image. Every human being has intrinsic value because they bear this image. It can neither be given nor taken. Even a rebellion against God resulted in us being image bearers on display. The opportunity now is for us as image bearers to display what it's like to have a God who is gracious against rebellion. That means that for the rest of your life, every person you engage, even when the two of you are on opposite sides of a conversation, the two of you are to recognize one another as image bearers and treat that person with the value that God has given them. Your opinion of them is irrelevant. What did God say about them? You engage them according to who God says they are. Even in the midst of conflict, even when disagreement is the norm. I told a friend of mine the other day, I said, so I have this new policy now where since we don't know how to have intelligent debate, I can no longer watch political campaigns. I'm so glad campaign season is over. And you can pick a side, and I will tell you that about your side. I don't care, okay? You the third party, yours too. Okay, I cannot stand that we are willing to get up on television and tear someone's character down for the sake of winning an office that we can hold temporarily. The person of whom you're speaking is made in the image of God. When you assault them, you are speaking against the God who made them. About 7 or 8 months ago, I was invited to be a part of a roundtable discussion here in our neighborhood. I was invited by two pastors, neither of whom I knew. They're pastors that had just moved into the neighborhood. In fact, they did not know one another. And when I got there, I quickly discovered that they disagree on almost everything. So here I have two people who don't know one another. They disagree on nearly everything, and they're asking me to join them on a platform, and I don't know either of them, and be a part of the conversation that they want to have. And their discussion was regarding humanity and its value. And they disagreed on two key things. One of them was vehemently opposed to the number of police shootings that occur in urban contexts, and the other was adamantly pro-choice. So here they are arguing about this, and I'm just sitting there quietly, because I don't even know how to jump into this. I don't know how to double dutch my way into this mess. Like they're just arguing back and forth about a woman's right to choose and the injustice that occurs when it comes to the police shootings of unarmed black men. They're just going back and forth. And I'm very slowly packing my briefcase. Because I'm not trying to get in this. All right. Hey, guys, I got to not be here. So trying to figure out how to get out of the room, okay? But they want me to be one of the speakers at this conference that they're organizing. And they said, so where do you stand on this? Do you agree? Do you have a view on abortion? And do you have a view on police shootings? And I said, yes. And then the one who had the abortion discussion, he said, "So you're opposed to abortion?" I said, "Yes." And then the other one said, "That are you opposed to police shootings of unarmed men?" I said, "Yes." And that shocked them because they were making their decision according to which color their political party was. And they said, you got to pick a side. I said, I did. I picked God's side. I think both of you are overstating your case and misrepresenting an idea. They said, so where do you stand on this? I said, well, I believe that we should be very deliberate regarding injustice and confront that according to the value of human beings who are being persecuted. And I also believe that among the human beings who are being persecuted are unborn children. Where are you getting this from? I said, we preachers, right? This is what we do, right? This is what we... I said, there's a doctrine known as the doctrine of the Imago Dei, the doctrine of the image of God. So a man who is shot in the middle of the street, he's an image bearer, even if he's a criminal. So you do not play flippantly with a dead human being. The unborn child is an image bearer. They asked me, what is the doctrine of the Imago Dei? These are pastors. I said, well, I'm sorry. Genesis chapter 1. I was presumptuous when I came here. I thought we were here for Bible stuff, okay? Genesis chapter 1 speaks to the image that we are made in. And I said, I oppose the shooting of the man and the aborting of the baby on the same premise. Somehow, I have a view that disagrees with both of you. And now I know why. You haven't read Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. You have both missed the intrinsic value of, this is key, of all human beings. And because of that, each of you have chosen a group of human beings whom you've deemed valuable. And you restrict that value for them and don't apply it to everyone. Their question for me, so would you have mourned the death of Hitler in World War II? I said, don't go back that far. You don't have to go back that far. Don't do that. That answer is easy for me because I wasn't even alive then. I was in a class when the announcement was made regarding Osama bin Laden's execution, and my classmates applauded. And my professor stopped and said, what are you doing? An image bearer has died. One less display of God's royal majesty. You do not celebrate the death of a human. You cannot pick who has this value because you didn't give it to them in the first place. Now, God has commissioned us to live out the value. Now, here's the thing I want to fix real quickly. Turn to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. Hopefully, you've heard this before. If you've been here for a while, you have. Genesis chapter 3. Here's your context. There's a tree in the middle of a garden. God tells them that they can, that they are responsible for, Adam and Eve, that they're responsible for tending the garden. There's one tree from which they cannot eat. Eve then misrepresented what God said in her conversation with a serpent and said that God says we can't touch it. That was an adult tantrum. God said we can't touch this tree. That's not what he said. They're the gardeners. They have to touch the tree. Okay? And then she gives the fruit from the tree to Adam. They both eat from the tree from which they were not allowed to eat, and that results in their spiritual death, their brokenness. They hide from God. God shows up and says, Adam, where are you? Everyone should take note of this. Adam and Eve both hid, but when he came into the garden, he was looking for Adam, because Adam's the one who was the federal head in the scenario. He's not just Eve's federal head. He's our federal head. So when he fell, we all fell. We all experienced this death, this rebellion. His cosmic treason became our treason. Also, you should take note of this. Whenever God asks a question, he's not trying to get information. He's omniscient. He knows everything. So when he says, where are you? That's him saying, Adam, fess up. Because he knows where he is. It's dumb to hide from God. Wherever you go to hide, God's going to be right there. He's also omnipresent. When you ran and hid behind that tree, God says, what are you doing? That's the context. That's the context. And then God places a curse upon him. Look at what he says starting in verse 14. The Lord said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all the beasts of the field, and on your belly you shall go, and thus you shall eat and all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. Verse 15 is the first prophecy of the coming Christ. Christ is going to come and he's going to break the head of the serpent, and he's going to suffer injury in the process, but the injury will not be unto death, because 3 days later he's going to get up. Verse 16, to the woman he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childhood. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be contrary to your husband, but he shall rule over you. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. Now here's what you should understand. He just gave all three of the parties involved the curse that comes as a result of them consuming from the tree from which they were not supposed to eat. Now, we have presumed that the curse he placed upon them is a part of being human. It is not. It was never God's plan that this brokenness would be the experience of human beings. The daily struggles are the result of us being the descendants of the cosmic rebellion. We inherited the curse. The reason you endure pain during childbirth was because of Genesis chapter 3. The reason I was tired in that airport is because of Genesis chapter 3. The reason I can weed and feed and water my lawn to my heart's content and not get the grass as green as I want it, and then I can completely starve and poison weeds that are trying to pop up in cracks in my driveway and cannot keep them from coming, that's because of Genesis chapter 3. When I see Adam, we're going to have a misunderstanding. Man, for years, I'm putting down weed killer. Can't get the weeds to die. Put down grass feeder, and the grass like, I don't know. I don't really know. It's because of Genesis 3. Every time I'm out there, just that's my Bible study, Adam. And we think that's because we are human. No, it is because we are fallen. We have a habit of saying to err is human. We think that sin is essential to our humanity. It is not. If you need evidence of that, remember this. The Christ who redeemed us was not just God. He was also man. And guess what he never did? Sin. His humanity is identical to yours, with the exception of the fact that he bypassed Genesis chapter 3's curse. So the thing that plagues us did not plague him. He was able to live a sinless life and a display for us what a quintessential human being is. Sin is not intrinsic to our humanity. It's intrinsic to the fall. Now, here's what that means. It means that as image bearers, your life is to be one where you war against the sin that calls you, because it's not a proper display of who you are. You are to war against the sin. There's a great moment where Jesus encounters Peter and says, Peter, listen, the enemy, Satan, he's couched at the door seeking to devour you. And he says, but I have equipped you to handle this matter. Well, we have this whole thing where we always quote this passage in the New Testament from 1 Corinthians 10, where he says, God will not put more on you than you can bear. He'll never put more on you than you can bear. And we use that in reference to trials. Guess what? That passage has nothing to do with trials. We are reading that passage completely out of its context. That passage has nothing to do with trials. Let me pause here for a second to tell you something. There's a stained glass secret. God will put more on you than you can bear. Yeah. If you've been going through life and you've been suffering through something, you're like, I must be able to handle this, because God would not put more on me than I can bear. Yes, he can. Yes, he will. Yeah, you know why? So that you, when you get to the other side of that suffering, you can say, no one brought me through the suffering except God. If you can handle it, then God will sit back and let you handle it, and you can boast on the other side. No, no, no. He will put more on you than you can bear when it comes to suffering and trials. Be mindful of that. But you know what the passage is actually referring to? Temptation. He says, you will never be tempted beyond your capacity to resist. So don't ever find yourself in a moment of temptation where you say, I gotta do this. It's my human nature. Actually, it's not. It's your fallen nature. You will wrestle with sin for the entirety of this present life. But guess what will happen on the day of the resurrection? Both sin and sin's consequences are removed, and you will then be what God always intended for you to be. You are to live according to that deliverance, not according to the present struggle. You live with that forward deliverance in mind. Don't demote yourself to someone who must rebel against God. Sin is not essential, it's not fundamental to being human. We wrestle with it because of what occurred in Genesis chapter 3. Is the wrestling real? Yes. Don't hear me downplay that. Is it a legitimate temptation? Yes. In fact, I would contend that Jesus' temptation in the wilderness was a real one, and he was able to resist it only because he was not suffering the burden of Genesis chapter 3 that is on all of us. Having said that, we cannot give ourselves a pass. Oh, well. Adam messed this up for us, so I got to live the life that Adam has chosen for me. No, Paul's response to that decision is, may genoita, may it never be. Romans chapter 6, he says, do not live a life of sin having been delivered from that identity. In other words, you do not look to Adam as the one who sets the standard for your humanity. You look to the quintessential human being, Jesus the Christ, yes, as the reference point. You are intrinsically valued, and you are called to be the saints of God who put God on display even when you don't feel like it. Sainthood is not what you will have one day. If you're in this room and you know Christ is your Redeemer, it's what you have now. And God has called you to do nothing except live according to who you are instead of working to become something. If you could work to become something, he would not have had to die on a cross to purchase it. So the question you have to ask yourself is, who am I and whose am I? Who am I and whose am I? Who am I and whose am I? My son went to work with me on Friday. He didn't go to school. If you work for DPS, sorry, that's how it works. Okay, so sometimes it's going to be a day where I look at him and say, you know what? Today is just a daddy-son day. So you're going to come hang out with me. I have never understood this a hyper emphasis on perfect attendance. As long as you're doing well in school, then sometimes, buddy, just come hang out with me. And so I'm that guy who go pick the kid up from school for a movie. I'm that guy. And I'm not gonna lie. I'm not gonna walk in and say, hey, my kids have a dentist appointment, so can take them to. I'm not gonna do that. I'm just gonna walk in and say, hey, I'm here for my kids. And they're gonna say, why? I said, cause they're mine. Yeah, that's all I got to say. That's it. Go get them. Or I can go get them. They're mine. I'll go get them, okay? But come on. And we're going to see Star Wars. So he hung out with me. He hung out with me in my office just all day. And he loves it because he sits at Pastor Derek's desk, and I'm at my desk, and so the two of us are just, we're at work. I didn't intend to have him there all day, but I had to get some stuff done, and then we're going to do some stuff. So he would say, Daddy, since Uncle Derek's not here, then this is going to be my desk. And he takes his iPad out, so he has a screen in front of him, and then I'm in front of my screens, and we're both working. And then I say, buddy, because he's a kid, right? So every now and then I have to do this, because he gets distracted. I say, buddy, do you need to go to the restroom? He says, no, I can't go to the restroom, daddy. I'm at work. Yes, which blesses my soul. You don't even understand. You don't even know. Every time he asks me, daddy, am I old enough to shovel the driveway? I said, boy, first of all, I love you. You don't even know how much I'm going to get all of that out of you before you move out of my house. You don't even understand. I'm glad to hear you talk like this. So I bought him a little snow shovel and everything. So I'm out there teaching. He doesn't get much done. But I bought him a little snow shovel because he's working with daddy. In fact, in his mind, he says, so I heard him tell his sister, Reese, you stay in the house with mommy because the men are going to go outside to clear the driveway. And my back was to him when he said it, and I was like, oh. Come on, son. You know what brings me joy? He wants to be like me. We have matching socks. He'll tell his mom, I want some socks like daddy. So she'll buy him a package, the miniature version, same package of socks. He'll put on a shirt like the shirt that I wear. He refers to those shirts as his work shirt. That's his work shirt. When he puts it on and he rolls up the sleeves and everything, I said, boy, you fly. You look like your daddy. He wants to be like me. Now, I don't see what a lot of you see. Because to me, he looks like his mother. But I can't tell you how many people look at him and say, he looks just like you. Now, I think they're more referring to his mannerisms and his attitude. He is me behaviorally. But when I look, I see his mother. But the thing that he did Friday that caught my attention was I had to run into the foyer for an appointment. And I left him at his desk. And I said, I'm going to go ahead and close the door so that no one can come in. I'm going to lock it behind me. He says, no, don't close the door, daddy, because then I'm a kid. And I can't be a kid if I'm at work. So just leave the door open. Now, I can still see him from where I was. So I'm like, okay, I'll leave the door open. So I went to the foyer, and I called my appointment from the exterior door, but I'm still looking back to make sure that he's fine. And I see a woman with a dog stop by the office. He's my child. So he said, hey, that dog can't come in here. I said, that's my boy. Goodness gracious. I mean, it's just like, okay, now I'm starting to see it now. And I hear them having a conversation, and she's asking him, so what are you doing? He says, I'm at work. What do you do? She said, he told her, I'm a pastor, like my daddy. He really did tell her that. She says, did you read all these books? He said, I haven't read all of them yet. Yes, she's engaging a 7-year-old. And he's responding to her with the agenda of letting her know that he knows someone who he's trying to emulate. So I get back, because I don't know this woman. So I get back to the office, and I speak to her as I go into the office, and she says, oh, he is your son. He is your son. He even looks like you. And not realizing what she was saying, she says, he is the spitting image of you. Now, I don't think he actually looks like me. I think he looks like his mother. I think my daughter looks like me. But you know what she noticed? He behaves just like me. He thinks just like me. Sometimes he uses that against me. He just things have to fall logically in his mind, and he doesn't know how to have an opinion that does not escape his mouth. And I look at him, I said, son, when I was a kid, my father would have whooped me for doing what you just did. But you see me doing what you just did. I can't even come at you like that because he is an image. He's an image of me. And people who do not know him but know me will look at him and say, he reminds me of you. Not because of necessarily the phenotype of the boy, but because of the behavior of the boy. He is made as a replica. He's a replica of my image. Listen to me. You cannot possibly look like God. You can't. Physically, you cannot. There's a preacher in Texas who told a bold-faced lie regarding having met God. And he says he's about 6 feet tall, maybe a little shorter, about 200 pounds, and his hand is a 9-inch hand span. There's a preacher in Fort Worth, Texas, who described God in that way. He says, I saw him in a vision. He's about 6 feet, 200 pounds, and a 9-inch hand span. And I said to the television, in fury, if I see your God, I'm going to whoop him. This is 11 inches. If I shake your God's hand, he's going to know who the bigger man is. I haven't seen 200 pounds since the seventh grade. Just got a physical the other day. I've been telling everybody I'm 6'2". And the woman says, the nurse says, no, you're not. You're 6'3". I said, no, I'm pretty sure. She says, I'm the one looking at, never mind, you're 6'3". I'm writing it down. I'm 3 inches taller than his God. I'm not talking about you looking like God because God cannot be diminished in that way. You will never replicate him physically. He's not a physical being. You can't do it. But behaviorally, you can put his image on display. Intellectually, you can put his image on display. Affectionately, you can put his image on display. And I love the moment when someone can look at you and say, you look just like your daddy. Let's pray. God, we thank you for giving us value beyond our ability to reason. We cannot imagine who you are for us and what you have made us to be. So give us hearts that go hard after you, become disciplined pursuers of you, students of you, lovers of you, so that we can properly display you. Move our pseudo image out of the way so that the image of the living God can be seen by the world. In the name of your Son, Jesus the Christ, we pray. Amen.